The Legal Sunday, the Constitutional Aspect of the Question, Chapter 1. Objections to Sunday laws on account of their nature as embodiments of the union of church and state. Judicial evasions of this historic fact examined. Objections to the religious grounds on which Sunday laws have been sustained. Some may think that we might well have stopped with the demonstration from history that Sunday laws represent and embody a union of church and state, because as soon as this demonstration is accepted, the inconsistency of such a union with American ideas of government must cause them to be swept from the statute book of every state without further argument. And when to this demonstration is added proof positive that Sunday laws are false in their essential basis and altogether pernicious in their results, the case might seem strong enough to leave to that intelligent jury, the American people. But the fact is that this historic truth that Sunday laws represent and embody a union of church and state has, under one pretense or another, been deliberately ignored by our judges for more than 100 years. And it is necessary that these pretenses be examined and exposed, lest anyone should imagine that they have been purposely avoided here, or that judicial ingenuity has ever discovered a single sound argument to offset the objections to Sunday laws which have been set forth in the preceding pages. But again, the question might be asked, if the courts have uniformly upheld these laws, is not that, practically, the end of the matter? The answer is no. This little book has a twofold purpose, one, indeed, in substance. Its one purpose is to discredit Sunday laws and to bring them into the utmost possible disfavor. Its twofold purpose is to initiate and stimulate a public sentiment which will one day force their repeal, and at the same time to show the fallacy of all the reasoning by which their right to exist in American statute books has been vindicated. And this last purpose is not quite so vain as to some it might appear. For, according to a well-established principle, it is not the cases, but the reasoning of the cases that makes the law. And even an overwhelming weight of authority may be weakened by a demonstration that the conclusions reached are not justified in any case by the premises from which they are drawn. And if no other reasons can be found than those alleged why these conclusions should be adopted, a clear-headed and right-minded judge may at any moment arise who will brush aside the casuistries of the rest and rule according to honesty and right reason alone. It is, indeed, only by repeated hammering that bench-made law is beaten into new shapes, fitted to the ideas and needs of an advancing civilization. The limits of this publication will not admit of an exhaustive examination of all the Sunday law cases in the United States or early English reports. An effort to group them properly and with reasonable completeness has been made in a little book called Sunday, Legal Aspects of the First Day of the Week by the present writer, Lynn and Company, Jersey City. But it is believed that in the following pages, the reader may safely calculate on finding, fairly stated, every argument ever judicially adduced to sustain these laws. And it is further believed with absolute confidence that it lies not within the power of the human intellect to devise one single argument to sustain them which is not here both fairly stated and fully examined. Future cases may follow more or less servilely the precedents, as Holt did the precedents for punishing witches. They may repeat, poll-parrot-wise, what has been said before. But it seems impossible that anything new should be found in them, so thoroughly has the ground been covered, so microscopically careful and exhaustive has been the search for casuistries wherewith to defend an untenable position in the past. The encouraging point is that, while the exposure of these old casuistries has been so complete that judges of the deepest dyed type of Brownism have learned to fight shy of them, yet for many a day no new casuistries have been devised to take their place. The field has been covered long ago, and an uneasy consciousness that the covering is not sound is making itself felt. Hence, we may confidently anticipate that what has sometime since begun will continue, or, in other words, 1. That the judges, in sustaining Sunday laws, will more and more confine themselves to referring to the authorities, and more forbear to consider the question on its merits, and 2. That they will be understood to do this because the defenders of Sunday laws have been driven from one citadel to another, until, as the thoughts of men are widened with the progress of the sons, it has become plainly evident to all judges of elementary common sense that Sunday laws have not one single merit to rely on in America. The divine command supposed to be embodied in the Brownist Sunday law is that Sunday shall be kept holy, and this law is designed to preserve the sanctity of the day in New York, 1 Ruggles case 290, and the Georgia statute is based on the fact that Sunday is a holy day, 2 Walden's case 449, and that of Iowa sets it apart as sacred, 3 Davis 22, Fish, and the same position is confidently taken in many other cases. There is some little confusion of ideas as to the manner in which Sunday acquired this character of sanctity. In New York, it seems to have been consecrated by statute, 4 Ruggles case 290, and in Georgia, it is the Lord's Day, as a mere matter of law. 1. The argument of this chapter proceeds throughout on the assumption that the idle and cheerless Sunday is a dogma upon which Christians are unanimously agreed. At every step of this discussion, as the reader will observe, it is necessary to concede some fallacy to the advocates of Brownist Sunday laws in order, so to speak, to get them into court. We must let them set up the men of straw with which they have so long deluded the people, so that the puppets may be satisfactorily bowled down. It has been shown elsewhere that the idle and cheerless Sunday, by civil law established, is not a Christian dogma at all, and was never introduced into the world of thought till Christianity was more than 1,600 years old, when it was evolved out of the inner consciousness of the Brownist sect of the Puritan sect of English Protestants. And, moreover, that the idle and cheerless Sunday by civil law established is by no means accepted as a dogma by all, or even a majority of Christians of today. Weldon's case, 449. But generally, the sanctity is ascribed to divine law, which is merely recognized by the state statute. 2. See Johnston's case, 102, Stockton's case, 186, Davis 22, Fish. Now the question of sanctity in a day, or a place, or anything else is manifestly altogether a question of religion, and an attempt to enforce by law the sanctity ascribed by any religion to a particular day, unless the sanctity ascribed by all religions to all days be recognized in the same way, is so obviously a preference of one religion over another that it has been repeatedly accepted as such, and as such sustained by the courts. It will not be denied that to defend an acknowledged preference in the very teeth of a prohibition of any preference is a task worthy the highest efforts of judicial casuistry, and worthily has it been discharged. Blackstone, of course, who is nothing if not logical, puts breaches of the Sunday laws among his offenses against God and religion, 3, Volume 2, page 264, considering these laws as passed for the enforcement of a religious dogma, in which, their true character, they are well enough in a country where the church is by law established. But, calmly ignoring the fact that according to the theory of our American constitutions, there is not and cannot be any church here by law established, many American judges adopt the English view and still uphold American Sunday laws. We are boldly told that the purpose of the compulsory idleness required by these laws is to turn men to the duties of religion and enforce the observance of religious duties. 1 George versus George, H. 27. To promote and establish religion among us. 2 Dupre's case, Bright, 44. And to induce the observance of the duties of religion in society. 3 County versus Price, 341. And that the day is wisely recognized by law as a day of rest to be devoted to religious contemplation and observance. 4 Moore versus Hagen, Ken, 437. And plenty more citations to the same astounding effect may be found in Sunday, etc., the work already referred to. The religious character of Sunday laws being understood, it remains to demonstrate the claims of the religion recognized by them to be considered as an exception to those provisions against preferences to which all other religions are subjected. The absence of any express exception in the provisions themselves strongly militates against the idea that it was intended by the Constitution makers that any exception should exist. And it is a bold thing indeed for a court to engraft an exception of its own on a constitutional provision which is not only as general in its terms as it could well be made, but which is utterly valueless if weakened by any exception whatever, and is, therefore, by such a judicial construction, practically nullified altogether. Yet it is true that an exception to a general rule in one part of the Constitution may be created by the language of another part, where such a construction is necessary in order that both parts may stand. Now, the religion which is supposed to be entitled to a preference in the recognition of its sacred day, and to receive that honor in the shape of a Sunday law, is Christianity. And its right to be considered as an implied exception to the provisions against preferences between religions is based on the fact that it is a part of our constitutional law, having been a part of the common law, to which nearly all the state constitutions declare that the people are entitled. 5. See the reasoning set forth in quotations in Sunday, etc. As already observed, these declarations are usually accompanied by some such phrase as so far as applicable, etc. But even without any qualifying phrase, they do not justify the assumptions based upon them. Let us concede that Christianity is part of the common law referred to in our constitutions. Even then, it would not follow that Christianity is part of our law. It is an established rule of interpretation that where one construction will allow two clauses of a constitution or statute to stand together, and another will require the sacrifice of one or the other clause, the first construction is always to be preferred. Now, if we infer that the adoption of the common law carries with it the adoption of Christianity, as just observed, we destroy completely the provision against preferences between religions. All that the majority of any legislature has to do is to determine that the teachings of one particular sect constitute Christianity, and its right to a preference to be made a church by law established, and to insult every other aggregation of believers with its tolerance, or persecute them at its own sweet will, is at once demonstrated. On the other hand, to maintain intact the provisions against preferences between religions does not destroy the adoption of the common law, but merely fixes an exception thereto. The two clauses, standing together, amount to simply this: the common law of England is adopted here, save and except so much of it as is connected with the English union of the church and state, and so much is in terms repudiated. There are various provisions in every state constitution which qualify the adoption of the common law, besides the prohibition of religious preferences, such as the prohibitions of hereditary titles, bills of attainder, etc., etc. No court would think of nullifying these safeguards by appealing to the most general terms of the adopting clause. Yet the guarantee of religious equality is more valuable than all the other repudiations of common law atrocities put together. The fact is that the claim that Christianity is a part of American law proves too much. We have seen that it enables the legislature to set up at any time an established church of its own. It is hard to see why this right does not involve a duty, why our legislators are not bound by their oaths to settle just what is and what is not Christianity, and to incorporate in statutes whatever else they may conclude to be its dogmas besides the idle and cheerless Sunday. In England, no court can sit in judgment on the constitutionality of an act of Parliament. But the courts in this country have always admitted that the constitutionality of Sunday laws is properly within their purview. So, presumably, it will be when other religious dogmas besides the idle and cheerless Sunday have become a part of the statute law. And a fine, ennobling, and essentially American spectacle we shall have when our judges undertake to distinguish heresy from orthodoxy, and such questions as the difference between homoousion and homoiousion come to be argued at our trial tables. Absurd as this suggestion sounds, it is no more absurd than the attempt to establish the idle and cheerless Sunday as an American institution, on the ground that it is a part of the Christian religion. The right and the duty to establish and maintain a part involves the right and duty to establish and maintain the whole. And neither a part nor the whole can be established or maintained without determining in some way the claims of the part or of the whole to be considered Orthodox Christianity. And this brings us to the fatal difficulty about the view under consideration. If, at any time, the position of the idle and cheerless Sunday as a Christian institution is assailed, then its right to exist as a state institution can only be settled by an express judicial settlement of the question, what is Christianity? And, as before observed, our courts have no means whatever of settling this question. They are furnished with no standard by which to discriminate between orthodoxy and heterodoxy. They cannot decide what are and what are not canonical writings. They can determine neither the original reading, the correct translation, the significance, nor the application of any passage in a religious book. In short, they are not ecclesiastical courts, and cannot adjudicate the rival claims of churches to be exclusive or superior guardians of the Christian truth. If any demonstration of the verity of this objection to the civil maintenance of Christian institutions as such were needed, it would be found in this very case of Sunday laws. A large and increasing class of Christians hold that Saturday, and not Sunday, is the Christian Sabbath. What is an American legislature or an American court that it dare undertake to decide between them and others such a point as this? If the answer comes, but the majority decides, then this is answered in turn by saying that the majority, or what passes for the majority, can decide no such question without an act of revolution. The very object of constitutional guarantees is to limit the power of the majority, to enumerate points which it shall not be permitted to decide, and among the points mentioned, in one phrase or another, in every American Constitution, is this very point of deciding between religions, and thereby extending preference to one or the other. The matter is here dealt with as though the only question was one of preference between one community of Christians and another. But in truth, the preference would be the same, though all Christians were agreed as to the day and the obligation and manner of its observance. For there are other forms of religious belief among us besides the Christian, and it needs no argument to show that to recognize the Christian Sabbath and refuse the same recognition to the Hebrew Sabbath, for example, is to make a preference of very decided character between two very different forms of religious belief. Nor is the preference merely abstract or theoretical. According to the idea on which it is based, the idle and cheerless Sunday is forced upon a portion of the people because it is necessary that they should be idle and cheerless in order that others may preach and pray in a fitting manner and with due satisfaction to themselves. If this is so, then the same necessity exists on Saturday, and our Hebrew or Seventh-day Christian citizens are very far from a position of equality before the law, and very decidedly preferred against, and indeed are indirectly persecuted by the state when it allows them to be so disturbed by others pursuing their regular occupations and pleasures that a proper observance of their sacred day is impossible. This plain proposition has been conceded, and a desperate attempt has been made to reason it down. The attempt has never been made more heroically, or failed more conspicuously, than in the case now to be cited. The New York Constitution provides for the free exercise of religious profession and worship without discrimination or preference, with the usual saving of practices inconsistent with the peace and safety of the state. Considering the meaning of this language, a learned judge observes, "It would be strange that a people, Christian in doctrine and worship, and who regarded religion as the basis of their civil liberty and the foundation of their rights, should, in their zeal to secure to all the freedom of conscience which they valued so highly, solemnly repudiate and put beyond the pale of the law the religion which was dear to them as life, and dethrone the God whom they openly and avowedly professed to believe had been their protector and guide as a people. Unless they were hypocrites, which will hardly be charged, they would not have dared, even if their consciences would have suffered them, to do so. Religious tolerance is entirely consistent with a recognized religion. Different denominations of Christians are recognized, but this does not detract from the force of the recognition of God as the only proper object of religious worship, and the Christian religion as the religion of the people, which it was not intended to destroy, but to maintain. Let us pass by the unconscious blasphemy of this talk about men dethroning deity. It is no worse than is often heard from the lips of the pious and well-meaning. It is not to be supposed that a Christian people will ever repudiate its religion. To put it beyond the pale of the law, so far from being a step toward its repudiation, is distinctly a manifestation of increased respect and veneration for it. And it is no extravagant compliment we pay to the men of the last age when we regard this constitutional provision as largely inspired by their consciousness of the essential degradation of their religion involved in its connection with the civil law. At any rate, they thereby did one of two things. They either placed their religion beyond the pale of the law, or they brought all other religions within that pale. For it is too plain for argument that to bring and keep within the pale of the law one religious profession and worship, and to exclude all others therefrom, is to make a discrimination, and to show a preference of the most decided character. Did the people who adopted this provision really regard religion as the basis of their civil liberty and the foundation of their rights? This is not the American idea. It is the divine right of the king in another form. By identifying the will of deity with the existing order of things, whatever that may be, this view renders any attempt to change that order of things, peaceably or forcibly, a direct flying in the face of providence, as the saying is, a rebellion like that of Satan, as described by St. John. It makes blasphemy, as well as absurdity, out of those declarations contained in the Constitution of New York and other states of the right of the people to change the form of their government whenever it shall seem fit to them to do so. How dare a Christian people alter in any wise that system of liberties and rights of which their religion is the basis? There is a sense, of course, in which religion, and the Christian religion of all others, is the basis of modern civilization, in which it has not only inspired the course of much legislation and influenced our public life, but has made itself felt in the multitude of transactions between man and man, which neither are regulated by law nor affect the community as a mass. Christianity permeates everywhere among us and plays a part in everything we do, because it is that pure and humble religion, as Gibbon calls it, which alone can at once suffice for the simple existence of Galilean fishermen and answer all the complex conditions of modern society. Because, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, the Master's kingdom is set up in the hearts of men, and his spirit is still working in the progress of the race. But to acknowledge this, his doctrine, as correctly defining its legitimate sphere of work, is, of course, to repudiate the use of the civil law either to define or enforce his religion. The learned judge whom we have just quoted observes that religious tolerance is entirely consistent with a recognized religion. Undoubtedly, as between religions, it even assumes this. Tolerance implies forbearance. It is the act of a superior toward an inferior. It involves the power to be intolerant at pleasure. It denies a right and asserts the granting of a favor. If the state tolerates, then she arrogates to herself a superiority to religion. If one particular religion tolerates the rest, it makes the same claim regarding them. No man intelligently and morally capable of true religious feelings will accept a tolerance of his religion at the hands of the state or of any other religionists. Religious tolerance cannot be tolerated in America. The complete disseverance of state and church, the absolute equality before the law, of all forms of religion and no religion, is the American ideal. In many cases, as in the citations above, we find the court ignoring the very language of the Constitution and dealing with the question as though there were no provision on the subject, or the provision were couched in language altogether different from that actually employed. Religious tolerance is entirely consistent with a recognized religion, says the court. Suppose it is. Who asks for religious tolerance? What has religious tolerance to do with the question? Where is religious tolerance mentioned in the Constitution of the State of New York? The article and section supposed to be under the purview of the court contains no such phrase as religious tolerance. It says, "The free exercise of religious profession and enjoyment, without discrimination or preference, shall be forever allowed to all mankind." Is there here the slightest suggestion of religious tolerance? The man who invokes such language as this against a Sunday law no more asks for religious tolerance than he asks for civil tolerance when he attacks the constitutionality of a statute which would deprive him of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. In both cases, he asserts a right against an attempted usurpation. He appeals, against legislative encroachment, to that fundamental law to which the legislature owes its existence, and by which it is as much bound as he is bound by any proper law it may pass. He has no more concern with the tolerance of the assembly than with the tolerance of his next-door neighbor. Both the assembly and his neighbors may be most anxious to impose their will upon him, to set him straight and keep him so, according to their notions, but neither extends him any tolerance when the strong arm of a constitutional provision is interposed between him and their well-meant interference. He stands on a perfect level with either, accepts no favors, tolerates himself no encroachment. The New York court did not dare to quote the language of the Constitution in the passage just cited, because the inconsistency of that language with the position which the court had set out to maintain would have been too glaring. Religious tolerance is entirely consistent with a recognized religion, says the learned judge. The recognition of one particular kind of religion by the state, to the exclusion of all others, accompanied by a tolerance of the rest, is entirely consistent with a constitutional prohibition of any discrimination or preference between religions, was too monstrous a doctrine for him to put into words. And yet, the second proposition, and not the first, was relevant and necessary to sustain his view of the law.
Having settled it that Sunday laws constitute a state preference of one kind of religion over others, and are therefore valid in states where such a preference is expressly forbidden, the courts come next to wrestle with the problem. Is the reluctant Sunday idler constrained to idleness for his own sake, or for the sake of those who would idle on Sunday without constraint? Is it the purpose of the law to force him to perform a religious duty required by the preferred religion, or merely to prevent him from interfering with the performance of that duty by others? The language of most Sunday laws is so general as to strongly support the idea that the spiritual betterment of the reluctant idler is what the state is aiming at. And many American cases take this reasonable view, which is the established one in England. See Fenelar v. Ridley and C. 406. Thus, the New Hampshire Sunday law is said to be designed to withdraw a man's own thoughts from secular concerns and turn them to the duties of religion. 2. Corsi v. Bath, H. 530. And it reminds the individual that he has religious duties to fulfill, and religious duties alone. Varney v. French, H. 233. The Massachusetts statute of our Puritan ancestors, which continues in force without any substantial modification, enforces by penal legislation the observance of the day, which consists in devoting it to public and private worship and to religious meditation and repose. 2. Davis v. Somerville, 594. In Pennsylvania, the Sunday law is sustained because it is of the utmost moment that the people should be reminded of their religious duties at stated periods. 3. Wolfe's case and R. 48. And in Kentucky, the object of the law is that the day may be recognized as a day of rest, to be devoted to religious contemplation and observance. 4. Moore v. Hagen, 437.
Now, it cannot be denied that any judge that takes this view of the purposes of a Sunday law
and imagines that he is justified in sustaining it on such grounds, is so completely blinded by the influence of Brownism that he is incapable of judicially considering the law at all. For a statute passed for the express purpose of turning a man's thoughts to the duties of religion on a certain day, of enforcing by penalty the devotion of that day to public and private worship, etc., must of necessity be designed to serve the purpose of a religious ordinance or decree, and to deal with matters that properly belong to such promulgations. And to pass a statute with any such purpose is to exceed the powers of an American legislature, to prefer one religion to another, and to set up pro tanto the union of church and state. So that if the reasoning of cases like those last cited were alone to be depended upon, Sunday laws would be doomed wherever the evil spirit of Brownism has not utterly enslaved the judicial mind. There is, however, another class of cases which, while sticking to the view of Sunday laws as essentially religious regulations, yet considers that their design is not to improve the spiritual condition of the reluctant idler, but to enforce idleness upon him in order to prevent him from interfering with the measures taken by other people for their own spiritual improvement. These cases maintain that the object of Sunday laws is the preservation of good order and peace, 1 Hagen's case, PR 76, and that these laws are passed in order that religious exercises may be performed without interruption, 2 Pierce v. Atwood, 324, and to prevent the disturbance of our citizens in their religious devotions, 3 Adams v. Gray, 358. And to protect the religion of the community, sick, from unseemly hindrances. 4. Smith v. Wilcox, J. 353. For it would be a small boon to declare the indefeasible right to worship God amid the din and confusion of secular employments. 5. Johnston's case, 102.
Now let us assume that the fact that idleness of the portion of the community which does not engage in religious exercises is a necessary condition to the proper performance of those exercises by the other portion, let us assume that this fact, if it existed, would be a sufficient reason for holding that an American legislature may make such idleness compulsory. The question then is, does any such fact exist? It does not. The claim that it does is insulting to the pious and utterly without foundation. It is insulting to the pious. For whether the devotions be regarded as public or private, to assume that the special police conditions of the Sunday law are necessary to their proper and satisfactory performance is to assume that the pious do not care to perform them on any day but Sunday. For it cannot be imagined that a pious person would engage in religious exercises under any conditions which rendered impossible their performance in a proper manner according to his light, and in a manner satisfactory to himself. But everybody knows that this claim that the provisions of the Sunday law are necessary for the proper and satisfactory performance of religious exercises, whether private or public, is as utterly false as it is insulting to the pious. Such persons know no Sabbath in their private devotions. Their petitions go up in the evening and the morning of the first day, and of all the other days of the week alike. Their family prayers may differ in length, but do not differ in kind, on Sunday, from those of other days. It has never been suggested by any of them that these exercises require compulsory idleness on the part of other people for their performance with perfect propriety and to the complete satisfaction of the performers.
The general reference, however, of the necessity of this compulsory idleness of other people is not to the matter of individual or private devotion, but to the exigencies of public worship. The fallacy of the claim and its insulting character is just as plain here as in the other cases. There are the Seventh-day Adventist, the Seventh-day Baptist, and the Jew. These all have their special weekday service of public worship on Saturday. They have never asked the state to make idleness on that day compulsory upon other people, in order that those services might be properly and satisfactorily performed by themselves. Alonzo T. Jones, Esquire, recently represented with consummate ability the Seventh-day Adventists in their great struggle against the attempt of the American Sabbath Union to commit the general government to a preference among religions.
See the National Sunday Law Argument before United States Senate Committee on Education and Labor, December 13, 1888. With the characteristic consistency and logical Christian spirit of the remarkable people to whom he belongs, Mr. Jones protested that he would be as dissatisfied with a national recognition of his scriptural Sabbath as he would be with the same recognition of the Sabbath according to Brownism. Any such proceeding he denounced as an embodiment of the union of church and state which his people were pledged to oppose at all times and in any degree, and without regard to whether their own or any other religion might be preferred thereby. But Mr. Jones went further and pointed out that the Seventh-day Adventists were in no wise whatever interfered with in their Saturday services by the work of other people, so that they did not need to have idleness made compulsory on others for the proper and satisfactory performance of such services, even if they felt that it would be right for them to ask the state so to prefer their religion. And, as just said, the experience of the Seventh-day Baptist and of the Jew is precisely the same. As a matter of fact, however, no pious person is willing to confine his participation in public religious services any more than he is willing to confine his private or family religious exercises to any one day in the week. Accordingly, we find the Roman Catholics with some sort of public religious exercise for every day in the year, and the Episcopalians observing, in like manner, Christmas, Good Friday, the Lenten period, etc. Yet neither Roman Catholic nor Episcopalian has ever complained that there is any lack of proper and satisfactory performance of either's public services on such occasions, occasioned by the fact that other people go on with their usual avocations and are not then compelled to be idle by act of the legislature. The so-called evangelicals of our time, those intellectual children of the New England Brownists, by whatsoever denominational name they may prefer to be styled, those to whose influence the enactments and spasmodic enforcement of every American Sunday law is due, hold public religious services on other days than Sunday. They have Monday night prayer meetings and Wednesday and Friday night prayer meetings, and certain among them are addicted to the practice of holding revivals, during the progress of which they have public religious services several times a day on every day in the week. Yet as to their weekday prayer meetings and their weekday revival meetings, it has never been hinted that the services or the results in the way of conversions have been in the slightest degree less satisfactory than the services or the results of the meetings held on Sunday. At the weekday prayer meetings, the average attendance is possibly smaller than at Sunday services. But if the Sunday law is designed to increase the attendance at church, its concern is with the individual whom it compels to be idle, and thus we are forced back to our first head and get rid of the question of his idleness being necessary to other people's public religious services. The revivals, however, seem to be about as well patronized on weekdays as on Sundays, though not altogether by the same class of people. Now all this, going to show that the special police conditions created by a Brownist Sunday law are not in fact necessary, or even of any particular value, so far as regards the proper and satisfactory performance of religious exercises, private or public, might seem to suggest the query, then, if no particular advantage in this regard is conferred, how is it that Sunday laws constitute a preference in religion and embody a union of church and state? And the answer is, they constitute such a preference, and they embody such a union, not because they enable one set of men to show by their conduct that they accept a certain dogma, but because they compel another set of men to conform thereto. The Brownist dogma which they enforce is not, "Thou shalt not interfere with other people's devotions on Sunday." There is no dogma on this subject, but there is plenty of law, and the law is at the service of anybody that needs it. The Jew, the Catholic, or the Brownist may hold public services at any time, and if anyone interferes with the same, the police will lock him up. The right of peaceably assembling exists on all days and nights, and needs no Sunday law for its protection. But this right has no relation to the character of the assembly as religious or otherwise. The law in America has no means of ascertaining its character herein. When this point was mooted respecting a spiritualist camp meeting, the court left it to the jury. 1 Fatal versus Middlesex R.R., 398. But this is a mere evasion.
an American jury can decide no question of which American law can take no cognizance. The character of a particular assembly as religious or otherwise cannot be legitimately submitted to a jury unless the court is prepared to instruct them as a matter of law, respecting the characteristics which distinguish a religious assembly from all others. It would be a usurpation for an American judge sitting as a jury to decide this question as to any particular meeting, because the law which he is sworn to administer gives him no guidance on the subject, affords him no means, confers upon him no authority to decide it. It is neither more nor less of a usurpation for him to render a judgment on a verdict whereby a jury has affected to decide this question respecting any particular meeting than it would be for him to render such a judgment after sitting himself as a jury on the case. The question being one beyond the purview of American law, and is not to be brought within it by the jury machinery or any other.
The law, then, protects the right peaceably to assemble, without reference to the object of the assembly, whether it be held in the interests of politics, religion, dress reform, or anything else, the prohibition of treason, riot, etc., being the one limitation of the right. And reason shows what the experience of Jews, etc., as well as Brownists, has demonstrated, namely, that a religious assembly differs not one iota from any other kind of assembly in its need of state protection. The ability to keep abreast with what is going on and to impress one's views upon others, the exercise of our faculties to the utmost in these directions, requires precisely the same police conditions at a religious assembly that it requires at a caucus, and no other police conditions whatever. And the establishment and maintenance of these identical police conditions for all lawful, peaceful assemblies of its citizens is the duty and the sole duty of the state with reference to such assemblies. And this duty exists without Sunday laws, on Sunday as well as all other days, and is constantly exercised on Sunday without any reference at all to Sunday law provisions. The interference with the proper and satisfactory performance of public religious services is disorderly conduct on Sunday or at any other time, and the interferer is punishable accordingly. It follows that Sunday laws, in this aspect of them, are, to say the least, superfluous and unnecessary.
It is an accepted maxim of American jurisprudence that the right of government to regulate the conduct of one man is limited strictly to the prevention of his interference with the legal rights of others, so that the unconstitutionality of the statutory requirement of Sunday idleness, if its sole object be to prevent the compulsory idler from interfering with the right of voluntary idlers peaceably to assemble for religious or any other purposes, the unconstitutionality of this requirement is demonstrated when it is proven to be superfluous and unnecessary in this regard. But now, busying themselves still with the religious aspect of the Sunday laws, and still adhering to our second view, that they are for the benefit of others than the reluctant idler, the courts have gone beyond this plain and irrefutable reasoning and invented a new ground for sustaining such laws based on religious considerations. They have found in them a necessary safeguard of certain rights, which they hold to be within the cognizance of the law, and which would be unprotected but for this requirement. And these rights are by no means confined to the circumstances of an assembly, nor even to the actual exercise of family or private devotion. They belong to the day, and have no essential connection either with the actual conduct of the voluntary idler, or with any actual objection he may feel to a temporary break in the compulsory idleness of another. Let us take up these propositions separately. A man may be neither at church, nor at family prayers, nor yet kneeling in his closet. He may be reading neither the Bible nor any other good book, nor meditating on religious subjects. He may be merely taking a walk and devising a scheme to despoil some Egyptian rival in Commerce Street on Monday morning. Nevertheless, the Sunday law protects him in rights intimately associated with the rights of conscience, which are worth preserving. The right to rear a family with a becoming regard to the institutions of Christianity and without compelling them to witness hourly infractions of one of its fundamental laws. 1 Johnson's Case, 102. And accordingly, it will prevent him from finding a grocery store open on his walk, because such a thing is shocking to the community's sense of propriety and brings into utter contempt the sacred and venerable institution of the Sabbath.
2. Shover's case, 259.
Now, it is plain that we have here something altogether unique in American law, namely, the assertion of its right to constrain one man to a certain line of conduct without the slightest reference to its physical effect on other people. I witness one man working noiselessly in a field, and another standing quietly inside of his own grocery store on Monday. And if I call upon a policeman to arrest either man, upon the ground that the sight of his behavior is offensive to me, I shall be in danger of a jury de lunatico. I witness the same sights on Sunday, and if I make the same complaint, the men will be arrested and fined. What makes the difference? What is the nature of this offense against me, done by this noiseless work or business of another on Sunday, which I may invoke the police power of the state to punish, and which the doing of these things can by no possibility result in on any other day in the year? The answer has been given by a North Carolina judge, who truthfully says that Sunday work offends us not so much because it disturbs us in practicing for ourselves the religious duties or enjoying the salutary repose or recreation of that day, as that it is a breach of God's law and a violation of the party's own religious duty. 1 Williams Case, 400.
It has been shown that compulsory Sunday idleness on the part of one portion of the community is not necessary or even of any special advantage so far as the proper and satisfactory performance of religious exercises, personal, domestic, or public, by the other portion is concerned. It might seem to follow that no preference is necessarily given to the religion of these last by the Sunday law, but the cases just cited answer this point. The preference does not consist in providing for the religious exercises of the voluntary idlers, special conditions which have no connection whatever with the proper and satisfactory performance of those exercises. The Brownists are guilty of intellectual dishonesty in making this claim. Their Sunday law is neither desired nor passed with the slightest reference to religious exercises. It is desired and passed to give a preference to Brownism, and it does in fact give a preference thereto in this regard alone. It incorporates into the civil law a dogma of Brownism to the effect that men ought to be idle on Sunday, and by the infliction of civil penalties, it enforces submission to this dogma on those who do not accept it. And hence, it enables the Brownist to do what no other religionist can do in this free America of ours, namely, to have one whose views of religious duty do not coincide with the Brownists, punished for acting upon his own views instead of acting on the views of the Brownist, or, in other words, punished for committing a breach of his own religious duty, as the Brownist chooses to define and prescribe the same for him. It is undeniable that these last cited cases correctly state the spirit and purpose of the Sunday laws, and it is equally undeniable that not one single person who is interested in the existence and enforcement of these laws feels the slightest interest in any aspect of them save this alone. It is not because the Brownist would be interfered with or disturbed in any manner whatsoever respecting his religious devotions, or in any other respect imaginable if there were no Sunday laws, that he is so concerned about such legislation. It is because he knows that they do constitute, in intention and in fact, a union pro tanto of the Brownist Church and the state, and for no other reason whatever, that he contends so hard for the life of these obsolete survivals of the English system. If we take the other horn of the dilemma, the advocates of Sunday laws are not one particle advantaged. To assume the special police conditions created by those laws to be essential to the proper and satisfactory performance of religious exercises, and to have the state create such conditions on a day observed with special religious exercises by one set of religionists while not creating them on the days so observed by other religionists, is plainly to give a preference to one religion over all others. And if one sect may constitutionally demand the creation of these special conditions on any particular day, every sect and every individual may no less demand them on any other day or during any portion of any day.
so that the outcome is that the traffic and business of the entire community is to be stopped by the police whenever any member or members thereof may feel called upon to preach or to pray. But the fact is that, as American law has no means of defining the character of a meeting as religious or otherwise, so it is without the ability to determine the character of any particular exercise, private, domestic, or public, and to say whether it be a religious exercise or not. The dancing dervish claims that his spinning around on one foot is a religious exercise, and American law cannot contradict him. And as that law is without the means of determining the character of any particular exercise in this regard, it cannot, of course, decide what, if any, special police conditions are necessary to its proper and satisfactory performance. If there be any peculiarity about such an exercise which causes it to require for its proper and satisfactory performance certain police conditions not required for the adequate performance of other lawful exercises, this peculiarity is altogether beyond the cognizance of American law. In other words, it cannot determine or punish interference with religious exercises as such at all.
And, as with the meeting, so with the exercises, discrimination in favor of those assumedly religious is as unnecessary as it is impossible on the part of the law. It is undoubtedly true that a proper and satisfactory performance of any exercise, bodily or mental, involves two sets of conditions, those of the environment and those of the performer's own mental and physical state. But this is no more true of religious exercises than it is true of mental exercises of any other kind. And in the case of all exercises, the law's concern is necessarily limited to the first set of conditions, namely, those of the environment. Thus, if one feels the need of the exercise of walking, the law will guarantee him the conditions of immunity from assault and robbery, freedom from obstructions on the highways, etc., etc. But it can by no means guarantee him that he will not lose the entire benefit of his walk by reason of his worry of mind over the conduct of another on the Sunday of his promenade or at any other time. Just so with religious exercises. The law will guarantee the citizen that they shall not be interfered with by the conduct of other people any more than other lawful exercises. But while it will protect the privacy of the closet and the hearth against the intrusion of annoying people, it cannot undertake to protect the mind of the worshipper against the intrusion of distracting thoughts. The reason for the distinction and the absolute necessity for preserving it are plain enough. The law deals with external things alone. The protection it gives to the citizen is protection against injuries which may be done him through some one of his five senses. The agencies at its command to ascertain and punish injuries do not avail beyond this limit. Now, if religious meetings and religious exercises differ in no regard from other meetings and exercises so far as their requisite environment is concerned, it follows that they need no Sunday law for their proper and satisfactory performance, unless there is a necessity for them in order to prevent some internal disturbance, some perturbation of the mind, apart altogether from any assault on the senses. And this is, in truth, the very necessity and the only necessity that Sunday laws are designed to meet. Well has it been said, Sunday work offends us not so much because it disturbs in practicing for ourselves the religious duties or enjoying the salutary repose of the day, as that it is in itself a breach of God's law and a violation of the party's own religious duty. 1 Williams Case, 400. This is the very keynote, the gist and substance of the whole matter. In the mind of the voluntary Sunday idler, there is a distracting thought that somebody, somewhere, is not idling like himself. And it is the disturbance thus caused to him, and that disturbance alone, against which he demands the protection of a Sunday law. But, as already said, such a disturbance, whether in religious exercises or in any other, is a mental or spiritual injury, and, as such, it belongs to a class of wrongs beyond the cognizance of the law, whether in connection with religious exercises or any other.
It is an offense to the emotions or sentiments alone, involving no physical or temporal consideration. The same observation applies to all injuries of a purely mental character, a class or genus of which we are considering only a species. Very cruel many such injuries are, involving often more suffering than great physical outrage. They may be done by language, silence, acts, or omissions, and work inexpressible misery, yet give no cause of action at law or in equity. Parental affection, wifely love, political faith may be outraged as well as religious sentiment, yet domna obsque injurias alone be inflicted.
Take the case of a public political meeting. One might say with reason that a sawmill running next door to his meeting place prevented him from keeping his mind steadily and profitably on the political instructions or exhortations of his favorite orator. But equity will enjoin the running of the mill for no such reason. The injury is spiritual or mental, and therefore beyond the cognizance of the law. Between the favorite orator and the favorite preacher, the law can make no distinction without setting up a union of church and state. Disorderly intrusion on any meetings may be prevented or punished, not because devotions or politics are interfered with, but because the meeting is disturbed. The fact that one of them happens to be a meeting for the purposes of devotion is altogether immaterial in the eyes of the law, and gives it no claim whatever to any special degree of protection. Take the case of private meditation or devotion. One might well say that the sawmill prevented his reading with due appreciation his Homer, or doing himself justice in the production of a poem. The sawmill may run, nevertheless, and he can have no damages for its running. Between Homer and the Bible, the poem and the prayer, the law can make no distinction without setting up at once the union of church and state. It has been said that this is a necessary principle, which must be applied irrespective altogether of religion. Its necessity arises from the fact that injuries to the sentiments or emotions merely are of an intangible nature and vary in their intensity with the individual disposition of the injured party, to such an extent that no standard of damages can be established for their recompense. What to one person would be a source of mortification and grief for a lifetime might not affect another in the least. Hence the law, which never attempts impossibilities and merely represents, however roughly, the general consensus or common sense of the community, wisely ignores such injuries altogether. Not only will it refuse recovery for them when standing alone, but it will not even allow them to be considered to aggravate or increase the damages recovered for a physical injury. Thus, a mother may compel a railroad company to pay her for the killing of her son, but she is to be recompensed for the loss of his physical services, and the damages are to be computed on this basis alone. The injuries to her feelings, as, for instance, her agony of mind at seeing him mangled by the engine while she stood near, cannot be considered by the jury. Nor could it be shown, in order to increase the mother's damages, that she was more affectionate and fonder of her child than the ordinary run of mothers. Nor could the damages be diminished by proof that she was cold and heartless in her treatment of her son. Nor, on the other hand, would his affection or want of affection be in the least relevant. The law simply assumes that the mother has an interest in the life of her son, which may be computed in cash, having regard to his wage-earning capacity, etc., etc., and compensates her on the same exclusively business principle, so far as she is concerned, upon which life insurance is conducted. There is a general agreement about loud noises, bad odors, explosives, etc., etc., as nuisances, because they interfere with physical comfort or safety. And so the law embodies a consensus that, for physical reasons, having regard to a change in physical conditions, some things may be branded as nuisances both by civil and criminal law if done at night, which would not be so if done by day. But in the case of all these things, the standard of damages is the same for all classes of persons.
Bad odors are frequently more objectionable to one person than to another. Loud noises are distracting to some, matters of indifference to others. The proximity of explosives will alarm many, while a few will laugh at their terror. Of all these varying dispositions, these grades of emotional sensitiveness, the law takes no notice, because, as said, to measure and judge of them is beyond its power.
Applying this principle to injuries to religious emotions or sentiments, we see at once that they are beyond the reach of law. There are Christians whose religious sentiments are shocked by the erection of a Jewish synagogue, and even more so by the building of a church for any other denomination of Christians than their own. But the law has no balm for their wounds. And the want of this general consensus respecting religious exercises, even if it were possible for the law to determine what are such, and even if their requirement of special police conditions were conceded, is an all-sufficient reason for the law's declining to give them greater consideration than it gives to exercises of any other sort. At present, there are many who say that all religious exercises are a sheer waste of time. There have always been thousands who have considered that, unless the exercises are conducted under certain auspices, they are considerably worse than a sheer waste of time. Between these varying opinions, the law has neither the jurisdiction nor the means to decide, and therefore it confines itself to keeping the peace at all times and allowing every citizen to indulge at all times in any sort of exercise not incompatible therewith, and to call it religious, or by any other name, according to his own will. Now, as already observed, the courts never miss the point in this connection except when they come to deal with Sunday laws. But the principle is just as applicable to Sunday laws as anywhere else. And its result, when applied to these laws, is to prove they cannot be sustained as measures for the protection of religious exercises.
But in truth, the construction judicially given to the Sunday laws when they are sustained on religious grounds refutes the assumption that they have any necessary connection with the question of religious meetings or private or domestic religious exercises. Of course, if their object were to provide certain police conditions required for such meetings or exercises, the fact that no such meeting was going on in the neighborhood or was actually interfered with, and that no such exercises on the part of any person were interrupted, would be a conclusive defense for the doing of an act on Sunday, which might be done on other days. But the irrelevancy of the question whether meetings or exercises have really been interfered with by Sunday activity is judicially settled by the view taken of the nature of that right which Sunday laws are held necessary to protect and of the disturbance against which they are designed to guard.
One of the definitions of to disturb given by Webster is to agitate the mind, and he adds that the mind is disturbed by envy. This is an excellent illustration for the purpose. A mere emotion may disturb, no sensation or perception of any kind is necessary. Whatever tends to awaken or kindle that emotion is the producer of a disturbance. The voluntary Sunday idler is thus disturbed by another's Sunday work, though he neither sees nor hears it. It weighs down his mind if he knows that it is going on. This knowledge arouses in him an emotion which, it must be admitted, is inconsistent with his use of the day for religious profit, being 90% pure malice. The disturbance done to him, we are told, and rightly told in the last citation, grows out of his conviction that for another person to work on Sunday is a breach of God's law and a violation of the party's own religious duty. And it is evident that the disturbance produced by the conviction that a party is guilty of such conduct beyond the reach of the Brownist's sight or hearing is quite as great when he is not engaged in any religious exercises, alone or in company, as when his services are actually in progress. Nay, it must be the greater when he is otherwise altogether unoccupied, because then he is able to concentrate his whole energies on the reflection that, at the other end of the town, say, somebody is doing what the Brownist does not think he ought to do on Sunday. And this reflection cannot be otherwise than disquieting to a Brownist, the vital essence of whose mental life is the fixed belief that it is his business to set other people straight, and the feeling that the dignity and authority of deity itself are insulted and defied by the perverse people who decline to be set straight according to the gospel of the Brownist. Plainly enough, it is the disturbance of himself by this disquieting reflection which the brownest voluntary idler wants a Sunday law to prevent. But we must not omit to notice an ingenious attempt to establish the position that the real purpose of the law is to prevent the disturbance of the non-brownest involuntary idler. The words, to the disturbance of others, are added to the prohibitions of work and labor in some of the statutes. They first appeared in the New Hampshire Sunday law. In construing them, the court adhered rigidly to the religious view of the statute, but adopted an entirely new view of its purpose. It considered that the object of compulsory Sunday idleness was not the spiritual betterment of the reluctant idler, nor the prevention of his interference with voluntary idlers in their religious exercises, nor yet the relief of their minds from the harrowing thought that somebody might be at work somewhere. At least, it ignored these aspects of the subject altogether, and enunciated the proposition that the real protege of the Sunday law is one compulsory idler whom another may disturb in his idleness, even with his perfect acquiescence. The court held that it was safe to give the word disturbance a comprehensive meaning, and that the fact that people willingly submitted to and took part in a thing did not make it non-disturbing to the party himself, or, in other words, that a man may be disturbed by doing what he wants to do. The court then went on to say that the object of the statute was to prevent the distracting of people from religious observance, and that nothing should be tolerated that tends to defeat it. And on the basis of this construction of the law, it set aside a contract to buy a horse, because the vendee was disturbed by the offer, which he willingly discussed, because a witness whom the vendee took with him to the conference was disturbed, though he went along willingly enough, and because the wife of one of the parties was disturbed, as was proven by the fact that while the transaction was in process of consummation, she sat in the room reading a newspaper. 1. And later, disturbance was said to consist in acts calculated to turn the attention of those who were present from their appropriate religious duties to matters of merely worldly concern, which evidently makes it a breach of the Sunday law to address a remark to a man on any other than religious topics, such, for example, as the state of the weather. And, accordingly, it was held that executing a will in the presence of others disturbed them. For, the court said, if business has been transacted of a secular character and not within the exceptions, and in which two or more persons have taken a part, the disturbance is a conclusion of law. 1. Varney v. French, H. 233. But common sense shows us that all this is uncommon nonsense. The question whether a man is disturbed or not by the conduct of another is so evidently a matter altogether within the man's own breast that the logical maxim of the law is volenti non fit injuria, that is to say, what a man willingly puts up with entitles him to no damages at law, gives him no disturbance of which the law can take cognizance. And this logical maxim is always respected and applied by the courts, save in the matter of Sunday laws, wherewith, indeed, logic has nothing whatever to do. But the brownest is logical enough when he is intellectually honest with himself. And then he knows full well that when he swears out a warrant against A on the ground that the latter has disturbed B by doing business with him on Sunday, he is seeking to have A punished, not for any disturbance done to B, because in fact there was none, but he is seeking to have A punished because of his knowledge that the business was done on Sunday, though he neither saw nor heard anything of it, and did not even know of its being done till long after the Sunday of its doing was over. This it is that disturbs the brownest soul to that degree that only the fining of A by the magistrate can restore its equilibrium. And it has been shown that with the matter of soul equilibrium, American law has, and can have, nothing to do. This ends our discussion and citations concerning the religious aspect of Sunday laws. It will not fail to strike the candid reader that there is something curious and suspicious about the very mention of religion in connection with the judicial consideration of an American statute. That American judges should be found recognizing the true character of Sunday laws as civil embodiments of a religious dogma and sustaining them on that very ground is only one among many illustrations of Macaulay's remark that man is such an inconsistent creature that it is impossible to reason from his belief to his conduct, or from any one part of his belief to another.